No sports, no rock, no information for mindless chatter. We're your station.
This is the Greenville Cub Scouts, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGSC, Agra, Catskill, and Hudson.
Very good.
Meow. We recommend this station.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, on another episode of Goodnight Norman, broadcasting to you live on WGXC Radio for Open Ears. WGXC.org on the internet and WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley. I really don't want to tell you anything about International Labor Day, the International Workmen's Holiday. But in 1889, the first meeting of the Second International was held in Paris. International demonstrations on the anniversary of a general strike that was called in 1886, known as the Haymarket Affair in Chicago. It was a general strike by workers for the 8-hour workday. And on May 4th, clearly the fourth day of that general strike in Chicago, the police acted to disperse a public assembly in support of the strike when an unidentified person threw a bomb. Police responded by firing on the workers. Allegedly, this led to the death of 7 police officers and at least 4 civilians. 60 officers were injured, and over 100 civilians. Labor leaders and sympathizers were rounded up, 4 of whom were executed by hanging after a trial that was basically a kangaroo court. The next day in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the state militia fired on a crowd of strikers, killing 7, including a schoolboy and a man feeding chickens in his yard. Thus, events in the United States of America led to what is now the celebration of workers around the world, everywhere, in practically every country, certainly every country in the rest of the predominantly white world, known as Europe, but many other countries as well. I don't have an exact count. I'm not going to give you one, but it's not a Soviet holiday, if any of you even know that it is a holiday at all. But it's basically called Labor Day. So the only country that doesn't celebrate International Working Men's Labor Day, or Workers' Labor Day, I shouldn't have said Working Men's, International Workers' Labor Day, the only country that doesn't celebrate it is the country wherein the events took place that are commemorated on this day. That country is the United States of America, who many of you think is a country that's entered a dark period because of some celebrity figurehead. But of course, America is a capitalist country. And you've been in the dark all along because you don't know that it's International Workers' Day. You think Labor Day is in September and don't know that that was the intentional doing of your masters in order to throw you a bone long after Labor Day had been established in every other country in the world. But you can bow down to the oligarchs forever. Won't do you any harm, apparently. Not that it's doing you any good. I think last year I read from the book that's put out by the Radio Workers Union. It's called Labor's Untold Story. I'm not going to bother with that this year, since most of you don't really care or want to know. But as if I was a celebrity, let's pretend that I was a celebrity. We'll look into something more compelling to the American audience. Not quite White Lotus. But on this date, many years ago, I lost my virginity. Well, I mean, I had sexual intercourse, consenting, of course, with a female who was actually 3 months older than me. So I was seduced by an older person. No, that's not true. We were already boyfriend and girlfriend, holding hands and all that. And we'd engaged in all the various kinds of heavy petting prior to that, typical of teenagers. But not to mention the fact that I'd also engaged in various sexual escapades with members of the not-so-fair sex prior to that. But anyways, that's what happened on May 4th many years ago. And so, in keeping with that titillating information, biographers alert, since I expect my biography to be huge, voluminous, rivaling that of Robert Moses, as penned by, what's that guy's name, Cairo? Anyways, I'm going to read some fiction that kind of has to do with this much more interesting topic than labor history, since we no longer have workers in this country anyways, merely consumers. This tale is called Lust. It was written by Susan, I should have looked up how to pronounce her name. Minot is how I've always pronounced it in my head. Susan Minot, M-I-N-O-T. lust. Leo was from a long time ago, the first one I ever saw nude. In the spring, before the Hellmans filled their pool, we'd go down there in the deep end with baby oil and like that. I met him the first month away at boarding school. He had a halo from the campus light behind him. I flipped. Roger was fast. In his illegal car, we drove to the reservoir. The radio blaring, talking fast, fast, fast. He was always going for my zipper. He got kicked out sophomore year. By the time the band got around to playing Wild Horses, I had tasted Bruce's tongue. We were clicking in the shadows on the other side of the amplifier, out of Mrs. Donovan's line of vision. It tasted like salt, with my neck bent back because we had been dancing so hard before. Tim's line, "I'd like to see you in a bathing suit," I knew it was his line when he said the exact same thing to Annie Hines. You'd go on walks to get off campus. It was raining like hell. My sweater as sopped as a wet sheep. Tim pinned me to a tree. The woods, light brown and dark brown. A white house half hidden with the lights already on. The water was as loud as a crowd hissing. He made certain comments about my forehead, about my cheeks. We started off sitting at one end of the couch, and then our feet were squished against the armrest, and then he went over to turn off the TV and came back after he had taken off his shirt, and then we slid onto the floor, and he got up again to close the door, then came back to me, a body waiting on the rug. You'd try to wipe off the table, or to do the dishes, and Willie would untuck your shirt and get his hands up under in front, standing behind you, making puffy noises in your ear. He likes it when I wash my hair. He covers his face with it, and if I start to say something, he goes shush. For a long time, I had Philip on the brain. The less they noticed you, the more you got them on the brain. My parents had no idea. Parents never really know what's going on, especially when you're away at school most of the time. If she met them, my mother might say, "Oliver seems nice," or "I like that one," without much of an opinion. If she didn't like them, "He's a funny fellow, isn't he?" Or, "Johnny's perfectly nice, but a drink of water." My father was too shy to talk to them at all unless they played sports, and he'd ask them about that. The sand was almost cold underneath because the sun was long gone. Eben piled the mound over my feet, padding around my ankles, the ghostly surf rumbling behind him in the dark. He was the first person I ever knew who died later that summer in a car crash. I thought about it for a long time. "Come here," he says on the porch. I go over to the hammock and he takes my wrist with two fingers. "What?" He kisses my palm, then directs my hand to his fly. Songs went with whichever boy it was. Sugar Magnolia was Tim with the line rolling in the rushes down by the riverside. With Darkness, Darkness, I'd picture Philip with his long hair. Hearing under my thumb, there'd be the smell of Jamie's suede jacket. We hid in the listening rooms during study hall. With a record cover over the door's window, the teacher on duty couldn't look in. I came out flushed and heady, and back at the dorm was surprised how red my lips were in the mirror. One weekend at Simon's Brothers, we stayed inside all day with the shades down, in bed, then went out to store 24 to get some ice cream. He stood at the magazine rack and read through Mad, while I got butterscotch sauce, craving something sweet. I could do some things well, some things I was good at, like math or painting or even sports. But the second a boy put his arm around me, I forgot about wanting to do anything else, which felt like a relief at first until it became like sinking into a muck. It was different for a girl. When we were little, the brothers next door tied up our ankles. They held the door of the goat house and wouldn't let us out till we showed them our underparts. Then they'd forget about being after us, and when we played wiffle ball, I'd be just as good as they were. Then it got to be different. Just because you have on a short skirt, they yell from the cars, slowing down for a while, and if you don't look, they screech off and call you a bitch. What's the matter with me, they say, point blank, or else, why won't you go out with me? I'm not asking you to get married, about to get mad. Or it'd be trying to be reasonable in a regular voice, listen, I just want to have a good time. So I'd go because I couldn't think of something to say back that wouldn't be obvious, and if you go out with them, you'd sort of have to do something. I sat between Mac and Eddie in the front seat of the pickup. They were having a fight about something. I have a feeling about me. Certain nights you'd feel a certain surrender. Maybe if you'd had wine. The surrender would be forgetting yourself, and you'd put your nose to his neck and feel like a squirrel. Safe, at rest, in a restful dream. But then you'd start to slip from that, and the dark would come in, and there'd be a cave. You make out the dim shape of the windows and feel yourself become a cave, filled absolutely with air, or with a sadness that wouldn't stop. Teenage years, you know just what you're doing and don't see the things that start to get in the way. Lots of boys, but never two at the same time. One was plenty to keep you in a state. You'd start to see a boy and something would rush over you like a fast storm cloud, and you couldn't possibly think of anyone else. Boys took it differently. Their eyes perked up at any little number that walked by. You'd act like you weren't noticing. The joke was that the school doctor gave out the pill, like aspirin. He didn't ask you anything. I was 15. We had a picture of him in assembly holding up an IUD shaped like a T. Most girls were on the pill, if anything, because they couldn't handle a diaphragm. I kept the dial in my top drawer like my mother and thought of her each time I tipped out the yellow tablets in the morning before chapel. If they were too shy, I'd be more so. Andrew was nervous. We stayed up with his family album, sharing a pack of old golds. Before it got light, we turned on the TV. A man was explaining how to plant seedlings. His mouth jerked to the side in a tick. Andrew thought it was a riot and kept imitating him. I laughed to be polite. When we finally dozed off, he dared to put his arm around me, but that was it. You wait until they come to you. With half fright, half swagger, they stand one step down. They dare to touch the button on your coat, then lose their nerve and quickly drop their hand so you'd do anything for them. You touch their cheek. The girls sit around in the common room and talk about boys, smoking their heads off. What are you complaining about, says Jill to me when we talk about problems. Yeah, says Kitty, you always have a boyfriend. I look at them and think, as if. I thought the worst thing anyone could call you was a cock teaser. So if you flirted, you had to be prepared to go through with it. Sleeping with someone was perfectly normal once you had done it. You didn't really worry about it, but there were other problems. The problems had to do with something else entirely. Mac was during the hottest summer ever recorded. We were renting a house on an island with all sorts of other people. No one slept during the heat wave, walking around the house with nothing on, which we were used to because of the nude beach. In the living room, Eddie lay on top of a coffee table to cool off. Mac and I, with the bedroom door open for air, sweated and sweated all night. Excuse me, I can't take this, he said at 3 a.m. I'm going for a swim. He and some guys down the hall went to the beach. The heat put me on edge. I sat on a cracked chest by the open window and smoked till I felt even worse, waiting for something, I guess for him to get back. One was on a camping trip in Colorado. We zipped our sleeping bags together, the coyotes' hysterical chatter far away. Other couples murmured in the other tents. Paul was up before sunrise, starting a fire for breakfast. He wasn't much of a talker in the daytime. At night, his hand leafed about in the hair at my neck. One was on a camping... Oh, sorry. There'd be times when you overdid it. You'd get carried away. All the next day, you'd be in a total fog, delirious, absent-minded, crossing the street and nearly getting run over. The more girls a boy has, the better. He has a bright look, having reaped fruits, blooming. He stalks around, sure-shouldered, and you have the feeling he's got more in him, a fatter heart, more stories to tell. For a girl, with each boy, it's as though a petal gets plucked each time. Then you start to get tired. You begin to feel diluted, like watered-down stew. Oliver came skiing with us. We lolled by the fire after everyone had gone to bed. Each creak you'd think was someone coming downstairs. The silver loop bracelet he gave me had been a present from his girlfriend before. On vacations we went skiing, or you'd go south if someone invited you. Some people had apartments in New York that their families hardly ever used, or summer houses, or older sisters. We always managed to find some place to go. We made the plan at coffee hour. Simon snuck out and met me at main gate after lights out. We crept to the chapel and spent the night in the balcony. He tasted like onions from a submarine sandwich. The boys are one of two ways. Either they can't sit still or they don't move. In front of the TV, they won't budge. On weekends, they play touch football while we sit on the sidelines, picking blades of grass to chew on and watch. We're always watching them run around. We shiver in the stands, knocking our boots together to keep our toes warm, and they whiz across the ice, chopping their sticks around the puck. When they're in the rink, they refuse to look at you, only eyeing each other beneath low helmets. You cheer for them, but they don't look up, even if it's a face-off when nothing's happening, even if they're doing drills before any game has started at all. Dancing under the pink tent, he bent down and whispered in my ear. We slipped away to the lawn on the other side of the hedge. Much later, as he was leaving the buffet with two plates of eggs and sausage, I saw the grass stains on the knees of his white pants. Tim's was shaped like a banana, with a graceful curve to it. They're all different. Willie's like a bunch of walnuts when nothing was happening. Another's as thin as a thin hot dog, but it's like faces. You're never really surprised. Still, you're not sure what to expect. I look into his face and he looks back. I look into his eyes and they look back at mine. Then they look down at my mouth, so I look at his mouth, then back to his eyes, then backing up at his whole face. I think, who are you? His head tilts to one side. I say, who are you? What do you mean? Nothing. I look at his eyes again, deeper. Can't tell who he is, what he thinks. What, he says. I look at his mouth. I'm just wondering, I say, and go wandering across his face, study the chin line. It's shaped like a persimmon. Who are you? What are you thinking? He says, what the hell are you talking about? Then they get mad after, when you say enough is enough. After, when it's easier to explain that you don't want to. You wouldn't dream of saying that maybe you weren't really ready to in the first place. Gentle eddy, we waded into the sea, the waves round and plowing in, buffalo-headed, slapping our thighs. I put my arms around his freckled shoulders, and he held me up, buoyed by the water, and rocked me like a seashell. I had no idea whose party it was, the apartment jam-packed, stepping over people in the hallway. The room with the music was practically empty, the bare floor, me in red shoes. This fellow slides onto one knee and takes me around the waist, and we rock to jazzy tunes, with my toes pointing heavenward, and waltz and spin and dip to Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, or I'll Love You Just for Now. He puts his head to my chest, runs a sweeping hand down my inside thigh, and we go loose-limbed and sultry and as smooth as silk, and I stamp my red heels and he takes me into a swoon. I never saw him again after that, but I thought I could have loved that one. You wonder how long you can keep it up. You begin to feel as if you're showing through, like a bathroom window that only lets in gray light, the kind you can't see out of. They keep coming around. Johnny drives up at Easter vacation from Baltimore, and I let him in the kitchen with everyone sound asleep. He has friends waiting in the car. What are you, crazy? It's pouring out there, I say. It's okay, he says. They understand. So he gets some long kisses from me against the refrigerator before he goes, because I hate those girls who push away a boy's face as if she were made out of ivory soap, as if she's that much greater than he is. The note on my cubby told me to see the headmaster. I had no idea for what. He had received complaints about my amorous displays on the town green. It was Willie that spring. The headmaster told me he didn't care what I did, but that Casey Academy had a reputation to uphold in the town. He lowered his glasses on his nose. We've got 20 acres of woods on this campus, he said. If you want to smooch with your boyfriend, there are 20 acres for you to do it out of the public eye. You read me? Everybody'd get weekend permissions for different places. Then we'd all go to someone's house whose parents were away. Usually there'd be more boys than girls. We raided the liquor closet and smoked pot at the kitchen table, and you'd never know who would end up where or with whom. There are always disasters. Cece got bombed and cracked her head open on the banister and needed stitches. Then there was the time Wendell Blair walked through the picture window at the Lowe's and got slashed to ribbons. He scared me. In bed, I didn't dare look at him. I lay back with my eyes closed, luxuriating because he knew all sorts of expert angles, his hands never fumbling, going over my whole body, pressing the hair up and off the back of my head, giving an extra hip shove as if to say, there. I parted my eyes slightly, keeping the screen of my lashes low because it was too much to look at him, his mouth loose and pink and parted, his eyes looking through my forehead or kneeling up, looking through my throat. I was ashamed but couldn't look him in the eye. You wonder about things feeling a little off kilter. You begin to feel like a piece of pounded veal. At boarding school, everyone gets depressed. We go in and see the house mother, Mrs. Gunther. She got married when she was 18. Mr. Gunther was her high school sweetheart, the only boyfriend she ever had. And you knew you wanted to marry him right off, we ask. She smiles and says, yes. They always want something from you, says Jill, complaining about her boyfriend. Yeah, says Giddy, you always feel like you have to deliver something. You do, says Mrs. Gunther, babies. After sex, you curl up like a shrimp, something deep inside you ruined, slammed in a place that sickens at slamming, and slowly you fill up with an overwhelming sadness, an elusive, gaping worry. You don't try to explain it, filled with the knowledge that it's nothing after all, everything filling up finally and absolutely with death. After the briskness of loving, loving stops, and you roll over with death stretched out alongside you like a feather boa or a snake, light as air, and you don't even ask for anything or try to say something to him because it's obviously your own damn fault. You haven't been able to what? To open your heart. You open your legs but can't or don't dare anymore to open your heart. It starts this way. You stare into their eyes. They flash like all the stars are out. They look at you seriously. Their eyes at a low burn and their hands, no matter what, starting off shy and with such a gentle touch that the only thing you can do is take that tenderness and let yourself be swept away. When with one attentive finger they tuck the hair behind your ear, you do everything they want. Then comes after. After, when they don't look at you, they scratch their balls, stare at the ceiling, or if they do turn, their gaze is altogether changed. They are surprised. They turn casually to look at you, distracted, and get a mild, distracted surprise. You're gone. Their blank look tells you that the girl they were fucking is not there anymore. You seem to have disappeared. You're listening to Good Night Norman with your host, me, Norman Douglas. It's the 5th of May, 2025. If you were here from the beginning, you just heard Lust by the writer Susan Minot, Minot. Forgive me, Susan, for mispronouncing your name. If I did. I didn't mispronounce mine. This is WGXE, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, right here in the beautiful Hudson Valley. Hudson, Catskill, Acre, New York, 90.7 FM, WGXE.org on the World Wide Web. It's 12:33 in the morning. And the next tale I'm going to read is called Boys by Rick Moody. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys. And with them the ideas of boys. Ideas leaden, reductive, and flexible enter the house. Boys, two of them, wound into hospital packaging. Boys with infant pattern baldness slung in the arms of parents. Boys dreaming of breasts enter the house. Twin boys, kettles on the boil. Boys in hideous vinyl knapsacks that young couples from Edison, New Jersey wear on their shirt fronts. Knapsacks coated with baby saliva and staphylococcus and milk vomit enter the house. Two boys, one striking the other with a rubberized hot dog, enter the house. Two boys, one of them striking the other with a willow switch about the head and shoulders, the other crying, enter the house. Boys enter the house, speaking nonsense. Boys enter the house, calling for mother. On a Sunday in May, a day one might nearly describe as perfect, an ice cream truck comes slowly down the lane, chimes inducing salivation, and children run after it, not long after which boys dig a hole in the backyard and bury their younger sister's dolls 2 feet down, so that she will never find these dolls, and these dolls will rot in hell, after which boys enter the house. Boys trailing after their father like he is the second goddamned coming of Christ, goddamned almighty. Enter the house. Repair to the basement to watch baseball. Boys enter the house, sight of devastation, and repair immediately to the kitchen, where they mix lighter fluid, vanilla pudding, drain opening lye, balsamic vinegar, blue food coloring, calamine lotion, cottage cheese, ants, a plastic lizard that one of them received in his Christmas stocking, tacks, leftover mashed potatoes, Spam, frozen lima beans, and chocolate syrup in a medium-sized saucepan and heat over a low flame until thick. Afterwards, transferring the contents of this saucepan into a Pyrex lasagna dish, baking the Pyrex lasagna dish in the oven for 19 minutes before attempting to persuade their sister that she should eat the mixture. Later, they smash 3 family heirlooms, the last a glass egg, intentionally, in a 2.5-hour stretch, whereupon they are sent to their bedroom until freed, in each case 13 minutes after. Boys enter the house, starchy and pressed shirts and flannel pants that itch so bad, fresh from Sunday school instruction, blonde and brown locks, respectively, plastered down, but even so with a number of cowlicks protruding at odd angles, disconsolate and humbled, uncertain if boyish things such as shooting at the neighbor's dog with a pump-action BB gun and gagging the fat boy up the street with a bandana and showing their shriveled boy penises to their younger sister are exempted from the commandment to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might and thy neighbor as thyself. Boys enter the house in baseball gear. Only one of the boys can hit in their spikes in mismatched tube socks that smell like Stilton cheese. Boys enter the house in soccer gear. Boys enter the house carrying skates. Boys enter the house with lacrosse sticks, and soon after, tossing a lacrosse ball lightly in the living room, they destroy a lamp. One boy enters the house sporting basketball clothes, the other wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. One boy enters the house bleeding profusely and is taken out to get stitches. The other watches. Boys enter the house at the end of term carrying report cards, sneak around the house like spies of foreign nationality, looking for a place to hide the report cards for the time being. Under the toaster, in a medicine cabinet, one boy with a black eye enters the house, one boy without. Boys with acne enter the house and squeeze and prod large skin blemishes in front of their sister. Boys with acne treatment products hidden about their persons enter the house. Boys standing just up the street sneak cigarettes behind a willow in the Eli's yard. Wave smoke away from their natural fibers. Hack terribly. Experience nausea. Then enter the house. Boys call each other retard, homo, geek, and later necklace thug, theater fag, and enter the house, exchanging further epithets. Boys enter the house with nose hair clippers, chase sister around the house, threatening to depilate her eyebrows. Is that the word? Depilate? Oh, well, anyways. She cries. Boys attempt to induce girls to whom they would not have spoken only 6 or 8 months prior to enter the house with them. Boys enter the house with girls efflorescent and homely and attempt to induce girls to sneak into their bedroom as they still share a single bedroom. Girls refuse. Boys enter the house, go to separate bedrooms. Boys with their father, an arm around each of them, enter the house. But of the monologue preceding and succeeding this entrance, not a syllable is preserved. Boys enter the house having masturbated in a variety of locales. Boys enter the house having masturbated in train station bathrooms, in forests, in beach houses, in football bleachers at night under the stars, in cars under a blanket, in the shower, backstage, on a plane. The boys masturbate constantly, identically, 3 times a day in some cases. Desire like a madness upon them at the mere sound of certain words, words that sound like other words. interrogative, reminding them of intercourse, beast, reminding them of breast, sects, reminding them of sex, and so forth. The boys are not very smart, and yet, as they enter the house, they feel, as always, immense shame at the scale of this self-abusive cogitation, seeing a classmate, seeing a billboard, seeing a fire hydrant, seeing things that should not induce thoughts of masturbation, their sister, for example, and then thinking of masturbation anyway. Boys enter the house, go to their rooms, remove sexually explicit magazines from hidden stashes, put on loud music, feel despair. Boys enter the house worried. They argue. The boys are ugly. They are failures. They will never be loved. They enter the house. Boys enter the house and kiss their mother, who feels differently. Now they have outgrown her. Boys enter the house, kiss their mother. She explains the seriousness of their sister's difficulty, her diagnosis. Boys enter the house, having attempted to locate the spot in their yard where the dolls were buried 8 or 9 years prior without success. They go to their sister's room, sit by her bed. Boys enter the house and tell their completely bald sister jokes about baldness. Boys hold either hand of their sister, laying aside differences, having trudged grimly into the house. Boys skip school, enter house, hold vigil. Boys enter the house after their parents have both gone off to work, sit with their sister and with their sister's nurse. Boys enter the house carrying cases of beer. Boys enter the house very worried now, didn't know more worry was possible. Boys enter the house carrying controlled substances, neither having told the other that he is carrying a controlled substance, though an intoxicated posture seems appropriate under the circumstances. Boys enter the house weeping and hear weeping around them. Boys enter the house embarrassed, silent, anguished, keening, afflicted, angry, woeful, grief-stricken. Boys enter the house on vacation. Each clasps the hands of the other with genuine warmth, the one wearing dark colors and having shaved a portion of his head, the other having grown his hair out, longish, and wearing uncharacteristically a tie-dyed shirt. Boys enter the house on vacation and argue bitterly about politics. Other subjects are no longer discussed. One boy supporting the Maoist insurgency in a certain Southeast Asian country, one believing that to change the system you need to work inside it. One boy threatens to beat the living shit out of the other, refuses creme brulee, though it is created by his mother in order to keep the peace. One boy writes home and thereby enters the house only through a mail slot. He argues that the other boy is a crypto-fascist, believing that the market can seek its own level on questions of ethics and morals. Boys enter the house on vacation and announce future professions. Boys enter the house on vacation and change their minds about professions. Boys enter the house on vacation and one boy brings home a sweetheart but throws a tantrum when it is suggested that the sweetheart will have to retire on the folding bed in the basement. The other boy, having no sweetheart, is distant and withdrawn, preferring to talk late into the night about family members gone from this world. Boys enter the house several weeks apart. Boys enter the house on days of heavy rain. Boys enter the house in different calendar years, and upon entering, the boys seem to do nothing but compose manifestos for the benefit of parents. They follow their mother around the place, having fashioned their manifestos in celebration of brand new independence. Mom, I like to lie in bed late into the morning watching game shows. Or, I'm never going to date anyone but artists from now on. Mad girls, dreamers, practicers of black magic. Or, a man should eat bologna, sliced meats are important. Or, an American should bowl at least once a year. But these manifestos apply only for brief spells, after which they are reversed or discarded. Boys don't enter the house at all, except as ghostly afterimages of younger selves, fleeting images of sneakers, dashing up a staircase, soggy towels on the floor of the bathroom, blue jeans coiled like asps in the basin of the washing machine. Boys as an absence of boys. Blissful at first. You put a thing down on a spot, put this book down, come back later, it's still there. You buy a box of cookies, eat three later. Later, only three are missing. Nevertheless, when boys next enter the house, which they ultimately must do, it's a relief, even if it's only in preparation for weddings or acquaintances from boyhood. One boy has a beard neatly trimmed, the other has rakish sideburns. One boy wears a hat, the other boy thinks hats are ridiculous. One boy wears khakis, pleated at the waist, the other wears denim, but each changes into his suit. One suit fits well, one is a little tight, as though suits are the preliminary marker of adulthood. Boys enter the house after the wedding, and they are slapping each other on the back and yelling at anyone who will listen, "It's a party." One boy enters the house, carried by friends, having been arrested after the wedding for driving while intoxicated, complexion ashen. The other boy tries to keep his mouth shut. The car is on its side in a ditch. The car has the top half of a tree broken over its bonnet. The car has struck another car, which has in turn struck a third. Everyone will have seen. One boy misses his brother horribly, misses the past, misses a time worth being nostalgic over, a time that never existed, back when they set their sister's playhouse on fire. The other boy avoids all mention of that time. Each of them is once the boy who enters the house alone, missing the other. Each is devoted and each callous, and each plays his part on the telephone over the course of months. Boys enter the house with fishing gear, according to prearranged date and time, arguing about whether to use lures or live bait in order to meet their father for the fishing adventure, after which boys enter the house again almost immediately with live bait having settled the question. Boys boast of having caught fish in the past, though no fish has ever been caught. Remember when the blues were biting? Boys enter the house carrying their father slumped. Happened so fast. Boys rush into the house leading EMTs to the couch in the living room where the body lies. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys hold open the threshold. Awesome threshold that has welcomed them when they haven't even been able to welcome themselves. That threshold which welcomed them when they had to be taken in. Here is its tarnished knocker. Here is its euphonious bell. Here's where the boys had to send the door down, had to sand the door down because it never would hang right in the frame. Here are the scuff marks from when boys were on the wrong side of the door demanding. Here's where there were once milk bottles for the milkman. Here's where the newspapers always landed. Here's the mail slot. Here's the light on the front step, illuminated. Here's where the boys are standing as that beloved man is carried out. Boys, no longer boys. Exit. Okay, well, you're still listening, maybe, to Good Night Norman. Me, your host, Norman Douglas. WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears here in the beautiful Hudson Valley. Hudson, Catskill, Cairo, Accra, WGXC.org on the World Wide Internet. That was Rick Moody. The story was called Boys. Or it was written by Rick Moody. It was my voice. Okay, my voice is going to read this last story by Mary Hood. I don't know. Is this story the one I wanted to read? I don't think it's going to fit. I think it was a different one I had in mind. Where did it go? Okay. I think I'll read this one. It's by Jamaica Kincaid. It's called Girl. Wash the white clothes on Monday and put them on the stone heap. Wash the color clothes on Tuesday and put them on the clothesline to dry. Don't walk barehead in the hot sun. Cook pumpkin fritters in very hot sweet oil. Soak your little clothes right after you take them off. When buying cotton to make yourself a nice blouse, be sure that it doesn't have gum on it, because that way it won't hold up well after a wash. Soak salt fish overnight before you cook it. Is it true that you sing Benna in Sunday school? Always eat your food in such a way that it won't turn someone else's stomach. On Sundays, try to walk like a lady and not like the slut you are so bent on becoming. Don't sing Benna in Sunday school. You mustn't speak to wharf rat boys, not even to give directions. Don't eat fruits on the street. Flies will follow you. But I don't sing Benna on Sunday at all, and never in Sunday school. This is how to sew a button. This is how to make a buttonhole for the button you have just sewed on. This is how to hem a dress when you see the hem coming down, and so to prevent yourself from looking like the slut I know you are so bent on becoming. This is how you iron your father's khaki shirt so that it doesn't have a crease. This is how you iron your father's khaki pants so that they don't have a crease. This is how you grow okra far from the house because okra tree harbors red ants. When you are growing dasheen, make sure it gets plenty of water or else it makes your throat itch when you are eating it. This is how you sweep a corner. This is how you sweep a whole house. This is how you sweep a yard. This is how you smile to someone you don't like very much. This is how you smile to someone you don't like at all. This is how you smile to someone you like completely. This is how you set a table for tea. This is how you set a table for dinner. This is how you set a table for dinner with an important guest. This is how you set a table for lunch. This is how you set a table for breakfast. This is how to behave in the presence of men who don't know you very well, and this way they won't recognize immediately the slut I have warned you against becoming. Be sure to wash every day, even if it is with your own spit. Don't squat down to play marbles. You are not a boy, you know. Don't pick people's flowers. You might catch something. Don't throw stones at blackbirds, because it might not be a blackbird at all. This is how to make a bread pudding. This is how to make Ducona. This is how to make pepper pot. This is how to make a good medicine for a cold. This is how to make a good medicine to throw away a child before it even becomes a child. This is how to catch a fish. This is how to throw back a fish you don't like, and that way, something bad won't fall on you. This is how to bully a man. This is how a man bullies you. This is how to love a man. And if this doesn't work, there are other ways. And if they don't work, don't feel too bad about giving up. This is how to spit up in the air if you feel like it. And this is how to move quick so that it doesn't fall on you. This is how to make ends meet. Always squeeze bread to make sure it's fresh. But what if the baker won't let me feel the bread? You mean to say that after all, you are really going to be the kind of woman who the baker won't let near the bread? Okay, that was Jamaica Kincaid's very brief girl. I have to remind myself not deliver these impromptu monologues and just read. Because they always destroy the timing of this show, which is like really critical, you know. It's like really, really important to time the show correctly. And I haven't done that. So the next thing that I'm going to read it's not going to be complete. And I really apologize for that. I really do. Dennis Johnson's Car Crash While Hitchhiking by Dennis Johnson. If I'm not mistaken, this is anyways, a salesman who shared his liquor and steered while sleeping. Yeah, this I think is from Dennis Johnson's book of stories, Jesus' Son. Car Crash While Hitchhiking. A salesman who shared his liquor and steered while sleeping. A Cherokee filled with bourbon. A VW no more than a bubble of hashish fumes captained by a college student. And a family from Marshalltown who head-oned and killed forever a man driving west out of Bethany, Missouri. I rose up sopping wet from sleeping under the pouring rain and something less than conscious thanks to the first three of the people I've already named, the salesman and the Indian and the student, all of whom had given me drugs. At the head of the entrance ramp, I waited without hope of a ride. What was the point, even, of rolling up my sleeping bag when I was too wet to be let into anybody's car? I draped it around me like a cape. The downpour raked the asphalt and gurgled in the ruts. My thoughts zoomed pitifully. The traveling salesman had fed me pills. That made the linings of my veins feel scraped out. My jaw ached. I knew every raindrop by its name. I sensed everything before it happened. I knew a certain Oldsmobile would stop for me even before it slowed, and by the sweet voices of the family inside it, I knew we'd have an accident in the storm. I didn't care. They said they'd take me all the way. The man and the wife put the little girl up front with them and left the baby in back with me and my dripping bread roll. I'm not taking you anywhere very fast, the man said. I've got my wife and babies here. That's why. You are the ones, I thought. And I piled my sleeping bag against the left-hand door and slept across it, not caring whether I lived or died. The baby slept free on the seat beside me. He was about 9 months old. But before any of this, that afternoon, the salesman and I had swept down into Kansas City in his luxury car. We'd developed a dangerous, cynical camaraderie beginning in Texas, where he'd taken me on. Weighed up his bottle of amphetamines, and every so often we pulled off the interstate and bought another pint of Canadian Club and a sack of ice. His car had cylindrical glass holders attached to either door and a white, leathery interior. He said he'd take me home to stay overnight with his family, but first he wanted to stop and see a woman he knew. Under midwestern clouds, like great gray brains, we left the superhighway with a drifting sensation and entered Kansas City's rush hour with a sensation of running aground. As soon as we slowed down, all the magic of traveling together burned away. He went on and on about his girlfriend. I like this girl. I think I love this girl. But I got two kids and a wife, and there's certain obligations there. And on top of everything else, I love my wife. I'm gifted with love. I love my kids. I love all my relatives. As he kept on, I felt jilted and sad. I have a boat. Oops. I have a boat, a little 16-footer. I have two cars. There's room in the backyard for a swimming pool. He found his girlfriend at work.